Hello, and welcome to On Boys, real talk about parenting, teaching, and reaching tomorrow's men, the podcast that explores and explains boy behavior. We're your co-hosts, Jennifer L.W. Fink and Janet Allison. Join us as we discuss some of the most compelling issues facing boys today. Our goal is to equip you with the information and support you need to help today's boys grow into healthy, happy men. How important is college? That is a fraught question for many families, especially this time of year. High school seniors and their families are grappling with college applications, the economic realities of applying to and considering college, and looming admission decisions. And let's be real, it's a question that is on the minds of almost every American family. We've been told that education is the key to success, but it's priced like a luxury item. Our guest today is Paul Tuff. He is the author of The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us, as well as his previous books are How Children Succeed and Helping Children Succeed. Paul is also the father of two boys. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Curious, how old are your boys right now?
They are 4 and 10. I just dropped them off at school.
So you're probably not doing too much talking about college yet.
That's true. Yes. I have these conversations are still a couple of years away, but I feel like, you know, as with everything in parenthood, they're going to show up faster than I expect. So they're not that far off.
And increasingly, I know my kids already in middle school were starting to say, why are they asking us what we want to be? They feel like if they don't have a path figured out by eighth grade, that they're going to be behind the curve somehow.
Yeah, it's striking both in talking to the individual students who I interviewed for this book and in reading the literature and sort of understanding the science. How many, I want the message to be that you don't have to worry, that like, it, you know, take it easy, you can decide later on. But there is so much genuine pressure early on to get the sort of, resume fillers and test scores and everything else that contributes to college application. So I think, yeah, the system, we as parents put a lot of pressure on our kids, but I think the system does as well.
So let's talk about that a little bit first, because you know, reading your book, and Janet is a former educator. She still works with people in schools. Do you think that maybe what we really need to do is kind of change the dynamic around school and learning? It's become so focused on a means to a job, a career, and a good life. It just seems like this feeds into our collective anxiety. Like there's no learning to grow as a human.
I think you're absolutely right. So I think there is this pressure, especially in sort of, you know, competitive neighborhoods and families, to turn education into this race for a certain type of credential, a certain type of accomplishment. And it goes against what works in terms of learning. I think what is, I don't know if it's ironic or just complicated about this moment in education is that actually the kind of skills that turn out to be most valuable in the workplace, in a career, are also the sort of skills that you develop by taking a deeper interest in learning. You know, like, I mean, even like I've spent a lot of time reporting on liberal arts students, right? And so like I think the rap against the liberal arts is they're just a distraction. They don't train you with the sort of particular job skills that we need. But the reality is that so many young people, especially those with well-paying jobs, work in the knowledge economy these days. That's where the opportunities are. And the kind of skills that you get studying things like, you know, philosophy and English and history turn out to be really useful in a lot of modern knowledge economy workplaces. So I feel like the message we should be giving our students is get, you know, study what you're interested in, follow your passions, follow your interests, develop the ability to learn, that all of that matters a lot more than the kind of resume lines and test scores that you need to use on applications.
Yeah. And what you're talking about is developing as a human being. And I was a Waldorf teacher. So, you know, we're very much about bringing in the arts, bringing in music, and looking at all parts of history and stories and this importance of having the capacity and the love of learning. And as you grow and get, you know, I mean, we talk a lot about child development here, and our boys, especially at age 15, 16, 17, are not ready to decide what they want to be for their life. They're just not emotionally, mentally developed in that way. Some are, many aren't. And so we apply more pressure to them, which clearly, given suicide rates, anxiety, depression, it's not working.
Yeah, I think that you can expand that into the whole way that we think about higher education, that I feel like we push students in college to really, the fact that it's so expensive right now, you have to get everything you can out of it. You got to speed through it. You've got to, not make any wrong turns, not make any mistakes. And the reality is that these are, late adolescents and early adults who are going to make mistakes, right? And they're going to make lots of wrong turns. And I'm not exactly sure what the answer is, because the pressures, I think, again, don't just come from, over anxious parents. They come from the system itself. Like, it really is expensive. The stakes really are high. So I feel like the tricky thing for parents, and that I wrestle with as a parent as well, is how to find the right balance, how to sort of convey that level of seriousness to our kids, at the same time giving them the sort of freedom to do what every kid needs, which is experiment a little and figure things out and learn from mistakes and sort of stumble your way into an identity and a purpose and a path in life.
Here's an example of those high stakes that I just heard about last night. I was at the soccer banquet for my 16-year-old son, and I was sitting next to another mom. We are very fortunate. We live in a small community, 5,000 people in the community, a high school of less than 400 most years. But we had a gentleman in our community who started a business that has done extraordinarily well. And each year, they give out 15 Bachhuber scholarships. That was the gentleman's last name. Each one is $7,000 a year times 4 years. So when you are talking about a small community, like, there's a lot of power in that. Kids can go to school because of this scholarship, but they have to maintain a certain GPA to keep the scholarship. And so I heard about this one boy. He took AP Calc in high school because this is a path ahead. This gets you into college. This can earn you some credits. So he did that. He got credits. He then went into the next math when he started school, and he struggled because it was hard. And he didn't get the grade he needed, and he lost his scholarship, which threatened his ability to stay in college. Like, the stakes are really high for our children.
Yeah, in my book, I spent a whole semester in a freshman calculus class. So I relate to that story from the point of view of calculus. That class in particular, freshman calculus, is one that we are not organizing well in our colleges. It's partly for exactly that reason, that AP calculus sort of seems like a preparation for the next steps in math, but really it's not. Most students who take AP calculus in high school go back and take the exact same course in freshman fall semester for exactly that reason, right? It's easier to take the same thing again. But I feel like it's a signal, a symbol of how the sort of strange messages that we send to our kids about how to succeed in college, right? It's like, well, take the same course again. just do what you can to get the right grades. And, maybe it was a good idea for him to push himself a little bit and take a course that he didn't quite ace. Except that, the reality is, in order to keep the money you need to do everything exactly right. I mean, your community scholarship is an unusual case, but there are lots of those types of pressures, I think, that students feel to do everything right. And sometimes doing everything right in college is not actually the path to greater learning.
That's a thought-provoking point right there. So given the reality and the fact that this system is not going to change while my kids are working their way through, my youngest is 13, I doubt it's going to change by the time your sons are post-high school age.
Yeah, even the four-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. So what do we do as parents to kind of help our children manage this environment that is stress-filled, to encourage them to, follow their path and deal with the reality that it's really expensive?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you need to find a balance. And as with everything in parenting, those balances are hard to find. But I think there's a way to convey to students that these decisions that you make at the end of high school and the beginning of college really are important. They're worth taking seriously and getting information about and, you know, thinking a little more deeply than maybe our generation needed to do at the same age. But at the same time, I think we need to understand that students already feel a ton of pressure about that and that we need to do what we can to relieve that pressure. And, you know, if they don't feel ready to go right to college or make the decisions they need to make, then try and find, you know, a good path for them that's not through college at first. I think there's a lot of students who take a year or two, you know, taking a few courses at community college or doing a work experience that means something to them that they could feel good about. And I think there's a lot of, when students want to take a path to and through college that's not the standard path, I think they often feel a lot of you know, guilt and shame and like they've somehow failed. And I think that feeling actually makes it harder for them to find a happy pathway, right? But the reality is lots of students, you know, spend a few years doing something else before they get to college. And so making that a positive experience, so they're not just sort of spinning their wheels and working minimum wage jobs and not feeling good about themselves, but instead they feel like this is a separate chapter in my life between high school and college that I'm going to make meaningful for me and learn something from and be more prepared for the next step. That's a totally reasonable thing to do. Mm-hmm. But that's not every student. I think there are lots of students who are ready to go right to college. Mm-hmm. But sure. I feel like in those moments where students are feeling this sort of external pressure where it's not just what they want, but it's what they think they should want, I think giving them more of a sense of the range of possibilities that are out there can be really a helpful job for parents to take on.
Speaking of range of possibilities, I would love to hear your thoughts on vocational education and hear what you learned as you were researching this book, because that's a great pathway for many boys, especially. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that pathway.
Yeah. So in my book, The Years That Matter Most, I followed this one young man from a small town in Western North Carolina named Ori, who was, when I met him, just started studying welding in community college. And so I sort of used his story as a way to understand the process of being a young person trying to make your way into the skilled trades. And in lots of ways, I think it's absolutely a good path for lots of young people. But one of the things that I wrote about as I wrote about his experience was the fact that at the same time that he was making his way through college, there was this sort of national, very partisan political debate about the skilled trades as an alternative to college. There are people who were holding it up and saying, you know, you don't need to go to college. You can just go and become a welder and make a ton of money. And there, I thought from the point of view of my book, there were a couple of things that were wrong with that case. One was that most of those skilled trades, you do go through college. You go to community college. He was, you know, getting a 2-year degree. Learning how to be a welder is hard. Like, he had to take 13 technical courses with learning very complicated welding skills, as well as like metallurgy and math and English and reading blueprints. And so, you know, I feel like we shouldn't be holding up those skilled trades as an alternative to college, but just as one pathway through college. The other thing is, I don't think that we're being totally honest with our young people. And I think you're right, especially boys, about what kind of opportunities are out there for them in those trades. And there are opportunities. But one of the things that really struck me when I would, you know, read the way that people talked in public about welding is that they would focus on the highest end salaries, right? So there was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that talked about how welders make $150,000 a year. And then that talking point got spread throughout the media and certain political circles. And the reality is that the average salary for the median salary for an experienced welder is $41,000 a year. And those are not mostly starting salaries. Those are sort of mid-career salaries. And that's, you know, that's a decent wage, but it's pretty hard to raise a family on $41,000. And, you know, a median means that for everyone who's making more than $41,000, there's someone making less than $41,000. And so that doesn't mean that it's not a good path. It doesn't mean it's not a good career. But it does mean that we need to be honest with kids in high school and before and say, yeah, this is a path you can go. This is what kind of school you have to do to get there. And this is what kind of salary is waiting for you at the other end. And there are lots of young people for whom that's the perfect choice, but we need to be honest with them about both the process of getting there and the payoff once they do.
You know, the other part that I think sometimes is glossed over in conversations about the trades is the fact that many of those jobs are very physically demanding. And you can do them when you're 20 and you can do them when you're 30. But by the time you're 40 and 50, your body is paying the price for spending those years working with your body.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I also think that they are jobs that are, you know, there's a good likelihood they're going to change over the next couple of decades. They are automatable, right? So some of them aren't. And those are the ones that pay the best, the ones that are, you know, doing crazy underwater welds on ship hulls and things like that.
But I was going to mention that.
Right. So those are the ones that pay a lot. They're super hard to do. But I do, you know, there are more and more robots that weld than there used to be. And that's going to continue to be true in those sorts of skill trades. Again, it's not a reason not to go into it, not to follow that interest. But I think we have, you know, especially young people, especially young men, boys who feel stressed out. I think we have sometimes held up that pathway as a, like, you don't need to think about college. You don't need to think about any of this. Just put it all aside. Follow this path. You're going to be fine. And again, that sometimes can be true, but it is more complicated than that. And I think there are a lot of young men who follow that path because they think, okay, this is a way that I don't need to think about college. And then it does, you know, it's more, it's harder, it's more complicated, it's more expensive than they think. And they end up a few years down the road having gone down that path and it wasn't the right one for them. And now they're in their early 20s and sort of having to start that process again.
One of the things I found interesting about Ori's story, and this is true for, you know, so many people that are trying to find their way post-high school, is that his first plan wasn't go to college. It wasn't even go to community college and study welding. His story is a story of kind of figuring it out as he went along.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, his first plan was to join the military, and he couldn't for a variety of reasons, as you know from the book. I write in the book a lot about high achieving students, you know, students who come out of, especially low income, middle class, first generation students who come out of high school with a lot of ambition, but not a lot of family resources. And the system is, you know, puts a lot of obstacles in their way. And I think those are important to pay attention to. But a much bigger problem is the students who are not in the top of their class, but, you know, in the middle and the bottom of their class, who are low income without a lot of family resources coming out of high school. We just do not have a system in place to help those students. And there are always going to be students who don't love school, right? But we live in a knowledge economy, and it is very difficult to make a middle-class living, for, especially in support of family, without some kind of post-secondary credential. And I just feel like we're not being honest with ourselves, and we're not being honest with our young people about how complex it is to get from high school to the kind of education you need to really succeed. And so, yeah, I feel like Ori, when he got out of high school, was absolutely in that place where he just felt like he had very few options, and he was kind of right. I feel like we all need to do a better job of creating better options for those kids.
I'm wondering if there's not a link here between your previous books and this one. So in How Children Succeed and in Helping Children Succeed, you really wrote about and emphasized the importance of the non-cognitive skills, things like resilience and grit and self-control. You know, for somebody like Ori, he may not have had the academic grades to go ahead, but if you have resilience, you may be able to at least keep forging ahead and looking for the next thing.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. I think that, you know, when we can help our young kids develop those sorts of skills as well, they you know, they're going to get into difficult situations, whether they're, you know, at Princeton or at Catawba Valley Community College, where they're going to hit some kind of obstacle and they're going to need to dig deep in order to overcome that. And so I feel like, yeah, the kind of preparation that we can help them do and that they do themselves in middle school and high school to develop those non-cognitive skills, resilience and optimism and self-discipline, those really make a difference. And it's something I think that Ori struggled with. I do think that when he was successful, that was exactly what he was relying, what he was drawing on, those non-cognitive skills. I talk about that moment where everything was sort of against him and they'd lost their, they were about to lose their house they were renting. And he was just, he and his girlfriend were in a really tough situation and didn't know if he could get off the couch. And finally, after a couple of days, he did and figured out a way to get back to school. And that was absolutely a moment where that kind of non-cognitive skill matters. I think it's also, I mean, this is what I keep wrestling with in terms of those skills. I feel like the bigger problem is everything that was around Ori, right? And so just to put him in that situation and then to have him depend on his grit and resilience to get out of it, I feel like is setting lots of kids like him up to fail and to struggle. So I do think struggle is good, and I do think that the skills to overcome those struggles are important. But I also think we need to change the higher education system so that struggle, that kind of struggle, is not baked into it, and so that students can succeed without that kind of, without needing that kind of intense level of resilience.
So we talk a lot about, you know, if things would change, if this would change, if that would change. What are some practical steps? I mean, we as parents can, you know, try to take the pressure off our kids a little bit, but we're talking about a big, huge system here.
Yeah.
And how do we affect and begin to affect change?
Well, so I'll say that I think there are lots of answers and I think it's complicated, but I'll give two answers. One that sort of, I feel like individual parents can do to help individual students. And then one that all of us as citizens need to think about if we want to really reform higher education. So the fact that I think is especially useful for parents, you know, one step down the road. So we've talked a lot about applying to college and choosing college and trying to find the right option for right after high school. But there's also a lot of students who, once they get to college, who really struggle and mm-hmm. have a hard time figuring out how to make their way through. And that especially happens, I think, in freshman year.
Happens with boys as well.
I think you're right, yeah.
You know, you look at the statistics, and they're not great for boys getting through college.
Absolutely. And so I wrote a lot about this one sort of school of thought in psychology that looks at what they call a mindset. And a sense of belonging. And these psychologists, who include people from the University of Texas and Stanford, have identified freshman year especially as this moment where young people, their identity is sort of scrambled. They don't know, everything is so different than it was in high school. They don't know whether they can succeed. They don't know whether they can really belong. And in those moments, our brains, our minds, our psyches are looking for signs, for signals from the environment that we belong or we don't. And so we're really susceptible to those negative messages. And if we get a few negative signs, we fail a test, we have a fight with a roommate, we get a bill from the bursar that we didn't expect, all of those get sort of inflated in our minds. And we say, like, this is a sign that I don't belong here. And I think that's when a lot of young people, and again, especially young men, drop out. The intervention that these psychologists came up with that turns out to be really effective is a pretty simple one. It's just sending students the message, especially in freshman year, that things change. And it's useful for them to hear it from parents. It's especially useful, though, for them to hear it from near peers, from people who are a couple of years older than them who have gone through the same thing. And it's simply the message like, yeah, freshman year is hard. I didn't feel like I belonged either. I didn't know if I could find any friends. I missed everybody from high school. My first class was really hard, but then I just sort of hung in there and I eventually met some people and figured out my classes and now I'm doing much better. Like, that simple message is incredibly powerful when you are that freshman, because you feel like you're the first one to have ever gone through this. Mm-hmm. I think especially for boys who are less willing often to reach out and to, you know, have those deep conversations with their friends, they do feel really isolated and alone. So I think that's something that parents can do, you know, just not sort of leaning on it too hard, but just saying like, yep, I know it's hard. This is normal. I went through it too. Things are going to change. It's a really powerful message.
What you're saying really resonates with me, Paul, because I did not want to go to college after high school, but mm-hmm. my parents said, you know, you've got to go. We won't pay for you if you don't go. The whole story, mm-hmm. this was a long time ago, but I went for one semester and I came home. I didn't have any support, number one, in choosing my field of study. I didn't have any support in that place of like, yeah, this is really strange and it's a weird way to live and all of those things. And Christmas, I came home, I told my parents I was not going back, and I didn't, and they weren't happy. And then I did finally end up going after probably 4 more years, and I was married and pregnant. And I'll tell you what, that's a difficult way to get through college. Took me 7 years, but I did it. But that place of not having that social support in that freshman year is, I really agree with you. That's a crucial.
Yeah, I dropped out of my first college halfway through freshman year as well, so I can totally relate.
High five.
It's a rough moment. But one of the things that, so I think parents could do a lot to send better messages to their students, but so can institutions, so can universities. And, you know, I talked to this one young woman named Amy who had grown up in a suburb of Dallas, and I talked to her at exactly the same moment. So just after Christmas break, freshman year, and she was just miserable. Like, she had just gone home. So she had done poorly in freshman year, first semester. She had like dropped chemistry and failed calculus or the other way around. And she was pre-med. So these courses really mattered a whole lot. She had just been home for Christmas. She said she couldn't tell her parents how she was doing. She was very connected to her church, and she couldn't tell anybody in her church how she was feeling because she felt like they all looked up to her. So she was under an enormous amount of pressure. And then I didn't see her again for a few years, and then came back and had this, you know, bad feeling that she would have dropped out. But she didn't. It turned out that right then she found an advisor at school who said, like, you know, maybe you're not like, pre-med isn't really what you want to do. She had chosen dentistry as her course of study because she'd heard that you make a lot of money as a dentist without actually like caring. She didn't care about teeth or medicine or science or anything else. And so the advisor was like, you know, maybe you should think about studying something that you actually care about that means something to you. So she switched majors, got some different friends, but somehow like that personal connection from an advisor made this difference. And so I feel like, yes, there are stories like yours and mine where like at that moment you can not get that sort of connection and you can drop out and take a few years getting back in. Or you can have what Amy experienced, which was, you know, again, she was like really not doing well, but found someone who said, like, you know, maybe if you fix one or two things could be genuinely different, and you hang in there and that happens. And so I feel like that's something that, again, that institutions need to do a better job at, but that we as parents can do as well.
I want to ask you a question about helping our kids transition to college. One thing that you found as you were researching and reporting this book is that a problem for a lot of kids is the cultural shock. When they get to college, they are surrounded by wealth and privilege for many less affluent students. And like, this is a whole different world. Talk about your feeling like you're not accepted or you don't belong, that they kind of find that disorienting. I know I struggled with that in college. I believe my second son is currently struggling with that. I know my first son struggled with that. You know, he was working to support himself and put himself through college as best as possible. And his roommate, like, his grandpa paid for the whole thing because he, you know, basically discovered fracking. Is there something that we could or should be doing? I never really talked about this with my children, but would that be helpful to say, hey, you're going to bump into this?
Yeah, I mean, so it depends where they go. Like, so one of the sort of universal factors that I found in my reporting for this book was that there is this big stratification going on in higher education where students at the most selective institutions, Ivy League schools and similarly selective institutions, the student bodies are almost entirely made up of well-off students. And in some ways, that's always been true, but the stratification is even more than it used to be. And that creates, so there's two obstacles, right? If you're a low-income student, a high-achieving low-income student, one is very few students are admitted to those schools from low-income families. But the other is the few who are often really feel isolated and alone. Mm-hmm. And for good reason, they really are surrounded by lots of rich kids. So the big change that has to happen is we need to, you know, reform higher education so that there's more socioeconomic diversity, especially in those selective schools, so you don't feel so alone because there are other middle class and low income students around you. But until that day comes, I do think there's a lot, first of all, that the institutions can do, but also that we can do as parents to, yes, I think, explain to kids where, how that's going to work. And I do feel, you know, the students who I feel, so I just talked to lots of people who are, who were students at the time, who are, you know, adults looking back on their college years, who all describe the same sort of culture shock, just the strangeness of being not rich and surrounded by rich people. And it's a skill, you know, and I think it's an important skill. And I think that, that there are lots of signals there that make those low-income students feel alone and isolated and ashamed of themselves. But I think you can also feel a lot of pride in your working class roots, right? Like, I mean, if you are, you know, your son with that roommate, like you've overcome so much more than the kid whose grandfather is paying for everything and probably paid for, you know, the SAT tutor along the way and the lacrosse team in middle school and all of those advantages. So I feel like there, one of the things that I found in my reporting that I found really heartening is there is this sort of like first generation pride that's developing in some of these institutions where first-generation students, first-generation meaning their parents didn't go to college, first-generation students are finding each other and creating, you know, clubs and groups and sort of advocacy groups, both within campuses and stretching across campuses to say, like, this is who we are. And they're advocating for specific changes, which I, on the part of administration, which I think are good. But I think the more powerful impact of those groups is just their existence, right? Like, just the ability of giving low-income students on those elite campuses a sense that, like, this is not a shameful secret. This is who I am. And, like, I've overcome a lot to get here, and I should feel proud about that.
We talked about what parents can do. What kinds of things can we do as individuals and as communities to support some of these system-level changes that are going to have to happen?
So I feel like there's at least two ways that we can do that. So the big one, when I talked earlier about sort of what our role as citizens can be, I find the most shocking change that has happened in higher education over the past couple of decades that I feel like many of us are not fully aware of because of the way that it happened, is we have defunded public higher education in this country. So it's happened over the course of a few decades, but even since like 2001, most states on average have cut per student funding for higher education, public higher education, by 16%, which is a pretty big cut at a moment where all of the signs in the economy are that we need more and better educated young college graduates, and every other country in the world is investing more and more into public higher education. And so the effect has just been to shift the expense and the risk of higher education from institutions and the public to students, right? So you used to be able to go to a public college, whether it was a community college or a flagship institution, without spending much money, and you would get a pretty good education and you'd get out without much debt. And there's a reason to have a public higher education system that works like that. And we really don't now. And I think that the fact that it happened, those cuts happened sort of piecemeal, bit by bit, in one state after another, kept us as the public from having a voice in this. You know, we always, like, it was always like, well, do you want your taxes to go up 2% this year or not?
Yeah.
Say, well, no, we'd prefer not. But without really having a debate about, do we want to defund public higher education to the extent that we've done? So I feel like we've got to reverse that. We have to invest again in public higher education. And that's a political decision, you know, that really is on the level of state budgets. And so I think the biggest thing that we can do is advocate for that and vote for legislators who are going to spend more on public higher education, just so, you know, tuitions go down and student debt goes down. But on the private side, I feel like the way that we adults can, I think, help to affect change is often as alumni. So these, you know, private institutions are admitting lots of rich kids and very few poor kids. And there are lots of reasons that they're doing that. There are lots of incentives in the system, pressures in the system that are inclining them in that direction. But we need to create alternative incentives, right? We need to find ways to push them in the opposite direction. And I think alumni have this great power because they, you know, they are a stakeholder in the institution. They're also, you know, potential donors or actual donors. And so to be able to say, like, we want a fairer, more inclusive admission system that does not just favor well-off kids, I think that's something you can say to the institution you graduated from and have a real effect.
Where can people find you online if they want to, you know, look if you are doing speaking events, if they want to learn a little bit more about your books? And for all of our listeners, I highly recommend Paul's previous books as well. They are insightful. They have science in there. Just read them, especially if you have younger kids. You're going to want to read those first too.
Great. Thanks for saying that. I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Amazon and everywhere else. But the best place I'd encourage people to go is to my own website, which is paultuff.com.
What would be the takeaway you want families to get from this book?
I think I want families to talk about this stuff, you know, and I feel like one of the reasons that I wrote this book is to give individuals, including students, and certainly including parents, a different sort of vocabulary to talk about higher education. I feel like we tend to look at it just through this lens of like, what do I get for myself? What can I, you know, what are the pressures on my kid? What are the pressures on me as a parent? And I think that tends to be both anxiety producing, but also really isolating, that we all feel like we're in this alone, and we have to compete with our neighbors and our peers. And the reality is that we need to change the system in a big way. And we are all in this together. You know, higher education is a collective public good. Certainly at its best, it is. And, you know, your kid's education benefits me and my kid's education benefits you. And so I want, you know, in some ways, like there's some challenging news in this book. And I think it's useful for kids and parents and families to discuss that together. But my hope is that it will push us all toward a better, saner way of thinking about higher education, both individually as families and collectively as the public.
On this podcast, we talk a lot about the fact that you are not alone. So many parents of boys feel like their son is the only one who is struggling in school, who's having a hard time sitting on the rug during circle time. They think, there must be something wrong with me or my kid. And what we do with this podcast is we say, no, it's not just you. Look around. Yeah. Almost every other parent and family is dealing with the same thing. And that's what I hear you saying is true for higher education too. And there is power when we realize this. It's not just you and your family figuring out how to navigate the pressure and the expense and the financial and social what to do after high school. It's all of us. So when we can talk honestly about that, we empower our sons, we empower ourselves, and there is opportunity to make positive change.
Amen. I love that idea.
This episode is brought to you by Audible. We know that you don't have a lot of time to sit down and read. That's why you're listening to this podcast. Go deeper with audio content from Audible. You can download a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/onboys to download your free book and start listening. Again, that's audibletrial.com/onboys.
Thanks for joining us. We are Jennifer L.W. Fink and Janet Allison, and we are here to support you in parenting and teaching tomorrow's men.